Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we now return you to the Rish Outcast question and answer session already in progress. So yes, this is Rish Outfield, and this is the Rish Outcast, and yes, we are still doing the dang questions. You ready? Question number 5. If you succeed in your goals, whatever they are, what is the worst that can happen, huh? For example, if I succeed in my goals, the worst that could happen is that I would be so absorbed by my fascination with my business that I ignore my wife and my marriage fails. What are the consequences to your success, huh? What's at stake? I had a conversation with somebody just the other day who puts out a book every year or so. And she's about to put out another one. And the question in her mind is cover art. And I think I talked about cover art last time. If I didn't, I should have. Because that's one of those stumbling blocks that I always look for. It's an excuse that I am happy to point out. It's the illegal immigrants of my campaign is cover art, because I'm not very good at it. But I don't care. She, however, takes a great interest in her cover art, a financial interest, and also artistic interest. She wants the cover art for her book series to be similar to one another, obviously, and she wants them to be evocative of what's inside the book. She wants someone to see the cover art and go, oh, wow, that looks like something I ought to pick up, which for decades, at least since the 40s and 50s, that has been the point of cover art. The lurid cover art on pulp magazines was often given the credit for what sold and what didn't. Daw paperbacks had those yellow spines, and in the 60s and 70s, they would have these covers that were often the best part of the book. My friend Jeff would buy these books called hard case crime novels, and they were 21st century books or late 90s books, with retro type covers that were always, they always had a beautiful woman on them. They always had an element of danger or something, you know, almost an exploitive feel to them. And he frankly bought them because of the covers. He's like, oh gosh, I look at the cover and I almost don't need to read the book. Which is me digressing. This writer is really a good writer. And she wants the covers not to get in the way of her writing, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? She would never want somebody who would enjoy her book to take a look at the cover and say, it might be good, but I'm not going to take the risk. I don't like the cover. Anyway, good Lord, I'm sorry. I should have already started answering the question instead of this silly side trip. But she was considering going with a new artist, a professional artist, to do the cover of her book. And so she contacted one that she liked the work of, and he got right back to her with a quote. Is that what you call it? And it's an astounding amount of money. Holy cow amount of money. But she talked to me about it, and she said, hey, I don't have any kids. You know, I don't have a family. I don't have a mortgage hanging over my head. If I want to do this, if I feel like the investment in the cover will pay off enough to where it pays for itself in the amount of copies I sell that I wouldn't otherwise have sold, then I can do it. She's not got all these dependents that most folks do. You know, most people have a spouse and 2.5 kids or however many kids it is. I mean, it's never 2.5. It's always like 11. And because of that, you can't afford to not send Jimmy to college because you want to invest in this cover. And I mean, she has a certain amount of freedom in her life because of her situation, because of her responsibilities, because of her financial situation, which is a really reductive way of describing her. In fact, maybe I should cut all this out. I, too, don't have any kids. I don't have to worry anytime one of them, gets a cavity or, breaks his ankle. Okay, well, there goes all my savings to pay for that. I have been so lucky that I've not been seriously ill. I have injured myself a couple of times, but not since I was on my parents' insurance. And all it would take is something bad, me breaking my neck or breaking both my legs or whatever, and I'd probably be completely hosed. But this is me trying to answer the question. If that sort of thing doesn't happen, I'm fine. I've started to get a nest egg. I've started to get out from under debt enough to the point where I don't worry about it. In fact, I've gotten to the point where I don't have to worry about anything. Ah, gosh, that sounds really silly. I didn't mean it that way. Financially, if I wanted to buy something, I could. And, I said that to Big the other day. Well, now it's been 6 months. But we went to a convention together, and they had those things that they call hoverboards. They're not hoverboards. But you know what I mean. They call them that. And Big said, whoa, wouldn't it be fun to try and ride one of those? And there was an hour-long wait to test them out. For free, you could test them as long as you signed a waiver that said, one of the people today who tests them will get rectal cancer. As long as you don't sue us because it's you, go ahead and ride around as much as you want. And he considered standing in this line for an hour to get on this death trap contraption. And I said to him, dude, let's not waste an hour. If you want, I'll buy you one of those things. I have enough money to buy one for you and me and all the people here. Let's do that if you really, really want one. And he looked at me like, what kind of an a-hole are you for saying that? And I realized, okay, you're not supposed to say stuff like that. That's something Donald Trump would say. And I'm not Donald Trump. I don't have that kind of money. But I had enough money in disposable income where if I want to buy something, I could buy it. As long as it's not a yacht or something like that. But I didn't realize until I saw his reaction that you're not supposed to say that. So what I'm saying right now is the same thing. I shouldn't be saying this because I become unsympathetic. But look, I don't have a house of my own. And I don't have any kids and I don't have a wife. I don't even have an ex-wife. I only have me that I'm responsible for. Now, sometimes, I'll take the kids to school. Sometimes I'll take them to karate and take them out to eat or whatever. But the beauty of being an uncle is that if I don't want to, I don't have to. And the price I pay for this kind of freedom, I go to San Diego Comic-Con every single year, and it costs a fortune. I usually spend about $1,000 to go to San Diego Comic-Con each year. And I think last year it was more. This year it'll probably be more. I'm always able to excuse that by saying it's my one vacation a year. I'm able to write off everything. I write off my hotel. I write off the gas. I write off parking. I write off the tickets to the convention. I write off every single thing that I buy. And a lot of times, the things I sell from Comic-Con mitigate the trip. They pay for the trip. Now, nowadays, the people in San Diego have savvied up and they charge about $300 a night for a hotel room. And so, yeah, I don't break even anymore. I don't make a profit anymore. But I still am able to make enough money on going to San Diego that it's worth it to go to San Diego again next year. You know what I'm saying? I realize because I have a cousin that would like to go to San Diego Comic-Con, although he doesn't really. And I have Big Anklevich, who has gone to San Diego Comic-Con a couple of times, but they can't because they have all these responsibilities or they have a wife that will not let them. And I see that and I understand. In a way, I am lucky that I can do that if I want to. I can be that selfish. But the cost is I sleep alone at night. No one will mourn when I'm gone. If I ever do get hurt or sick, it's just me, and I'm, you know, in trouble. So he asked, was it the price of failure? What is the worst that could happen? I think he's saying, what is the price of success? I don't know. I don't have enough ambition or drive to ever actually pursue the kind of success you're talking about. If I got off my duff and I sent out my stuff and I got real buff and I said it's enough, then life would be different. I would give up this silly podcast. I would certainly give up the Doonstief, which is a hell of a lot more work than this silly podcast. I mean, and it's just so much work for so little reward. The actual consequence of success, if I were successful in the way that I wanted to be, is that I would have to move away from here and go and pursue my dream again in California. And in the back of my mind, I know that's never going to happen, but right before the back of my mind, my second to back of the mind, a little voice says, oh gosh, wouldn't it be neat to be able to do that again? And yeah, that would be a dream of mine. It's not ever going to happen, but it's also a dream that has a price. And if I did move back to LA, I would remember suddenly all the things that sucked about LA. I had a guy, and he had figured out a way to break into my apartment. And it wasn't until the third or fourth time, I think, that I found out what he had done. He had taken a blade of some sort, a knife or a razor blade, and he had cut a flap of my window. What do you call the netting on the window? You know, the screen on the window of my kitchen. And so he could jimmy up the window and then reach through that kitchen window and unlock the deadbolt on my kitchen door, and he was able to get in. And after he had taken what he wanted, he was able to pull down the netting and close the window. And I was always all like, oh no, I left the door unlocked or left the door open. I must have done it again. Holy cow, because how does this guy keep getting in? And somebody must have come along, or maybe I got home right before he was done stealing. Because one time I got home and the back door was open. The kitchen door was open, and he had brought some grocery bags in that he was filling with things that he was stealing, and there was one still there that was half full on my bedroom floor, and the door was open, and he hadn't been able to replace that little piece of netting. So I saw how he was getting in, and then I nailed that window shut. But enough was enough. I mean, coming home and discovering that somebody had been in your house and stolen a bunch of things, and then having it happen again and happen again, it made it not feel like home anymore. It made it feel, I mean, I felt violated. I always wondered, you know, what if he comes in the night while I'm here, kind of thing. And that was scary. That was not cool. And I got this job with the Marines. We were doing training of the new grunts that were going out. Role-playing kind of thing. They wanted actors to play Iraqis so that the soldiers would have some basis in training of how to deal with the populace And because I was working for the military, it wasn't private. It was all military run. I couldn't go home. I just had to stay with them. And when they said, you're done, you're done. And at night, I would be afraid. I'd be like, that guy is probably in my apartment right now. And he's come, and what is there left? You know, I would think about the things that were valuable to me and that probably taken, and the things that were irreplaceable. And I would worry so, so much. And then, you know, when I got home, he would either have come and done this thing or he had not. But it was little comfort if he had not stolen my stuff while I was gone, because I was afraid all the time. That's just one tiny little memory about what it was like to live in the city. And, you know, I got my car stolen. They took it for a joyride and they wrecked it. And I had to ask someone to drive me to the impound yard. And the police charged me $90 to take my car, which was wrecked. And I that was just really scary and sad. And it was a city thing when you're on your own, which I know means nothing. It has nothing to do with what's the price of success. But there's a price. Living your dreams, of going out there and pursuing your dream. And that was part of my price, was that I lived in squalor. I lived, I never had any money. I could not, as I've said today, just buy whatever I wanted to. I had to scrimp and save. And I remember there being times when it's like, uh-oh, I'm not going to make rent this month. Oh, shoot. You know, with the acting thing, it was like, I need a commercial. I need to book a commercial because that will pay enough so that I will be in the black for the month. But, you know, what if I didn't get it? Well, you know, I remember there being weeks where I worked one day in a week. And, you know, to pay rent alone, I think I probably had to work 12, 15 days in a month. And so, yeah, there was that. There were those kind of things. I got to pursue my dream. And it was a romantic lifestyle in a way, but it had a cost to it. I feel like I haven't answered the question. If you succeed in your goals, what is the worst that can happen? Give me a minute. I'm going to think about that. I think there is probably a better answer. It is so cold. Here's the funny thing is, today was nice. It's been nice the last couple of days. Nice for winter, not nice for the rest of the year. And so when I was leaving to go meet Big for our weekly let's hang out and talk and not podcast get together, I considered just going out without a jacket at all. And I was like, no, this is great. The sun was no longer shining, but I'd taken the garbage out to the curb and I was like, this isn't cold. Oh, this is fine. Yeah. And so I nearly didn't grab a coat. But what I did do was I grabbed, like, they call it a windbreaker. It's just, you know, like a very thin jacket. And I put it on and, oh, thank Buddha, I brought this jacket because it is so cold now. And I don't know how that happens. I blame gay marriage. But anyhow, it's all these hours later, and Big and I got together and we talked and we ate. We talked a little bit about the podcast. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't a complete waste of your time. But I didn't feel like it was a waste of my time at all. I mean, we talked about a lot of stuff. He's got things going on in his world right now that I find hard to understand because I'm not in his world so much. You know, I'm not in his shoes. And luckily, he feels like he can talk to me, even though it would be so easy to say, you can't understand, you're not married, you don't, no one is ever going to love you, so you can't understand what I'm going through. He doesn't do that. So it's cool that I have a friend. I know I've probably said this before, but it's cool that I have somebody in my life that wants to hang out with me, that doesn't mind that we stay out late and that he has to get up early to take the kids to school tomorrow, and that because we stayed out late, he's not going to get a full night's sleep. That's something that has always been kind of amazing to me. When I lived in LA, I had this friend, Chris, and I just loved that guy. I mean, I still do, but I haven't spoken to him in years. And Chris and I had lived together in the dorms at UCLA, and I really, really liked him, but I didn't think he liked me as much as I liked him. But for a little while, he said, hey, I know you like Saturday Night Live. I like Saturday Night Live. Why don't you come up to my place Saturday nights and we'll watch Saturday Night Live together? And he lived all the way, like, in Burbank, and I lived in Culver City. If you're not from LA, basically that's 20 miles apart. You know, it's not far apart in miles, but it is far apart in how long it takes to get there in Los Angeles. There's no direct route. You have to go around the city on the freeway, or you go through the city through, you know, just regular streets. But to me, it was worth it to go to his house, even though I knew that it would be 3 a.m. when I got home. And you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning is the only time in Los Angeles that there's no traffic. The only time when you can go as fast as you want and you can get somewhere relatively quickly. But because you had to get on one freeway and then get on the next freeway and then take this exit and get down, and now you're going east and you got to go east just a little while before you can finally go west, it would take forever. But I remember it being worth it because I had a friend that was willing to hang out and watch this with me. And, you know, I'd have to get up, not early, but early-ish the next morning. And I knew I would be tired, but it was worth it. Anyhow, I guess that's what I'm saying, is it's really cool that he is willing to do this. Because I've had friends that are like, well, you know, you got to go. This feels like another outtake. I'm not going to apologize that this is a very rambling episode where I just talk about whatever jumps into my head. Because that's what this show is. It's me talking. It's me occasionally sharing a story with you. Occasionally, Sir Fate Sean Connery going to come here and sing Battle Hip Hop of the Republic. But most of the time, it's just my feelings and my thoughts and whatever jumps into my head. So there's that. If my dreams came true and I were a successful writer, or let's say that my audiobook money started to come in to the point where that could be my whole job, then other things would suffer. You know, I'm a loner. I don't have successful romantic relationships. And I am aware that if my dreams came true and I fell in love and she fell in love with me and, you know, Little House on the Hill, first comes love, then comes marriage, I think next comes a baby in a baby carriage is the next step. I don't know. I've not done the math. But I'm aware that if these dreams came true, then I would put away the writing dreams. Then I would stop podcasting. Because why would I waste my time with that when I can spend my time, you know, she likes to watch America's Next Top Model. No, that's a dated reference. She likes to watch The Voice on NBC. And instead of writing, it would behoove me to watch The Voice with her and get emotionally invested in these singers and see, you know, who gets voted off each week, or I don't know how The Voice works. Maybe the judges vote. Maybe the audience votes. My guess is both, And, you know, the plans that I have for writing a sequel to, another sequel to Birth of a Sidekick would just be thrown out. You know, the things that I said I would do would be thrown out. And I think about that sort of stuff a lot. I think about, okay, a witch comes to your door and says, I'm going to take you back, and that girl that you loved when you were 22, or that girl that you loved when you were in high school, will love you back. And you can get a chance to see what life would be like. You can get a chance to live like the other half lives, but you can never write again. All the things that you have written in the all the years since then that has brought you peace, that have brought you joy, that have brought you a little bit of sanity, because a lot of times in your writing you exercise your demons. You think about things that you're afraid of and say, let me tackle that scenario in fiction and see how I would respond in nonfiction. All of that gets wiped out. Absolutely, I would trade that. It is me in my naivete saying the grass is always greener in somebody else's lake. And it's silly, I guess, that I'm thinking that. But the things that you didn't have, the things that you didn't experience, the times when you failed, your regrets often lie heavier than the times when things worked out all right. The times when you went left instead of right, and, you know, you got to your destination, or there was a happy ending, or, you know, everything worked out okay. You always wonder, why didn't I go right? What would have happened? Or, you know, and maybe in this case, because I'm cowardly, a lot of times I don't go left. And the writer's conference that I went to, they talked about, this is what you have to do to be successful, to make a living at your writing. And they never once, in all the panels I went to, and I'm trying to remember how many panels, let's say I went to 15 panels. Now, maybe it was only 12, but who cares? 12 is a lot. They never once mentioned talent. If you have talent, you will be successful. And I guess talent is overrated. Hard work is where it's at, what they were saying. But they said, if you follow these steps, you will be successful enough. I mean, you're not going to be J.K. Rowling, but you will be successful enough that you can make a living from your writing. And hearing that and believing that it was true, because it would have been easy to just say bullshit, because there's luck and there is talent. And what if you don't have either of those things? You think hard work is going to make up for it? On the panel, they were saying yes. Yes, it is. And I think there may be a lot of truth to that. But even sitting there believing what they said, I'm not willing to put in 8 hours a day writing and publish my novel and then go on immediately to writing the next one and just putting more and more of my stuff out there. So let's say that there is a formula to success. And if you follow this formula, you will be successful. Even then, I'm not willing to follow it. I guess I am content with mediocrity. I don't think I'm a mediocre writer, and I don't think the stories that I've written, all of them at least, are mediocre. But I went to a panel where they talked about how you become better as a writer. And if you're entering a bunch of contests and you're winning these contests, then the contests are too easy. You need to go to a higher tier where the competition is harder, where you are forced to evolve, forced to work harder, forced to be better. And I don't know that I'm willing to do that. You know, if they said, okay, you've got to send this out to 10 strangers and get all of the notes on it and then apply those notes, at least the ones where they're right, it will make your book better, make your book stronger. I don't know that I'm willing to do that. Because that's work. Because that's humbling. Because that's maybe going an extra mile, and I'm not willing to do that. I feel like this has been Confessions with Rish Outfield. Today's confession, I've got a tiny peepee. This has been a really bad episode, guys. I recognize that. I wish I had Sir Fake Sean Connery here to tell me, just to stop blathering. Let's move on to the next question. I just looked at the next question, though. Yes, I looked at it while I was driving. I only killed one person, and she was old. She was elderly. She looked like she might have been sick. So, you know, I don't blame myself. Okay, question 6. With the acclaim stacking up, surely other authors and aspiring personalities are reaching out, seeking advice. What advice did you give them? Or if you didn't, what advice would you give them if they asked? So is this still the hypothetical world where my dreams have came true? And, you know, I'm getting to write horror movies, and I'm able to pitch Disney a young Princess Leia spin-off movie in the vein of their wildly successful Han Solo spin-off movie. Or is this now? Are you saying that acclaim has come because I won a contest? Hardly. Recently, Justin Charles is one of our... he's our most slavish listener, and he uploaded all of our episodes, over 400 of them, to YouTube. And if any acclaim is going to come, it'll be because of that. If somebody discovers the show that way, or discovers our personality and is like, wow, hey, oh, I love these. In fact, YouTube is such a giant thing, it's such a sensation, that I wouldn't be surprised if the authors of the stories that we have put on YouTube gain new fans, new listeners who contact them and say, hey, I heard your... they contact Saul Lemerand and say, hey, I heard Good Day on YouTube. That story was effed up, man. You're a good guy. And he's like, wait, what? On YouTube? What the hell? Which hasn't happened, but surely will happen. Where somebody's like, hey, I didn't give you permission to put this on YouTube. You know, it didn't even occur to me until just now that that could be troublesome. Eh, oh well. The funny thing is that neither Big nor I have access to those files. So if somebody started complaining about, hey, you know, I sell that story now and you're putting it out for free on YouTube, that we wouldn't be able to take it off. He'd have to make either Justin do it or make YouTube take it off. So what was I saying? Oh, okay, you were saying that if fame comes, it would be really nice if there were new fans of the show. Every time we put out a new episode, or every time we get nominated for an award, or every time I record something for Pseudopod or Podcastle or Farfetched Fables. And when we first started the show, I would often ask other podcasts, you know, hey, can we do a story for you? And Escape Pod was the one that would stonewall us and say, we don't need your kind around here. But almost everybody else would be like, oh, sure. Hey, oh, that's great. That's cool. Because here's the thing. I mean, Escape Pod notwithstanding, who wouldn't want somebody to exuberantly narrate your story and do all the editing themselves so that you didn't have to do it? You know what I'm saying? If I had offered to do a story for Pseudopod, and Alistair Stewart or Merle Lafferty said, oh, but he wants me to edit it, I can understand them saying no. We have our own people to do that. But at the same time, you know, we've had people offer to do stories independent of us for the Dunstief. One author sent us completed audio stories and said, you know, feel free to run these, but, and this is going to sound self-serving, so take it with a grain of salt. It's my show. I want to be involved in every single episode. I want my voice on every single episode. I want to say that this is a story that either I picked or Big picked that we feel strong enough to dedicate our time to. And now if somebody else, there were a couple, like, oh, Brian Lincoln went out and he got a couple stories that he felt strongly about. Luckily, they were good stories. But in that case, even though he produced them and he did all the work, I still got to voice a character. Big still got to voice a character. It was still our show. So I guess I'm saying I can understand another podcast saying we don't want your help, or we don't want your kind of help. And that's fine. And with the exception of Escape Pod, that's fine. I have nothing of but respect for these other guys. And I'm really happy to do work for other podcasts. And, you know, I do a good job. And yeah, there have been some that have started charging, not charging, paying their narrators. And that's great. But I would still do it for free for these guys. You know, like when Dave Thompson ran the show, ran Podcastle, it was a delight any time he asked me to do a story. And there would be, you know, 5-6 months that would pass in between stories, and I'd be like, oh, geez, it's weird. It's too bad I can't do more of these. But with a show like that where there's a very large listening audience, I'm sure there are a lot more narrators offering to do what I do. In which case, I totally understand. And there are some stories I am not going to be the best pick for. I know that flies in the face of how good I am. But there are some stories that you'd be better off with an English narrator. You'd be better off with an Indian narrator. You would be better off with a female narrator. You would be better off with someone who sounds like a child or a youth. There's that. But that was a roundabout way of me saying the whole reason that I put us forth on that, saying, you know, hey, we'd be happy to do an episode for you. We would like to do an episode of your show, is so that we could be discovered on somebody else's show. The group of fans that listen to Starship Sofa would hear us and say, oh, I liked their narration a lot, or his narration a lot. Let's go check out their show. And I know I have talked to people who have become Dunstief fans from hearing us on the Drabblecast or from hearing us on something else. And that's great. So the point I was trying to make... Here, let me kill the engine for a minute. We'll sit in silence while I finish this. Point I was trying to make is hopefully there are a bunch of new fans. And as, you know, our fan base grows, that's fame. Right. There was a guy who said that he was in France and he saw somebody with a Dunstief shirt. And I don't believe it. I think it's a lie, but one of those beautiful lies, like, honey, you're even prettier than you were the day I met you. But Big believes it. Big believes there is somebody out there in France who owns a Dunstief t-shirt. And either way, whether it's a lie or whether it's true, that's awesome. Just the thought of that is really, really cool. So let me give a thought as to what kind of advice I would give. I mean, obviously, the first bit of advice, it is the chief number one all caps advice, read your story aloud. I would recommend that to anyone, unless you're Stephen Hawking, in which case maybe you have a machine read the story aloud. So I've started recording my novel, Into the Furnace. And, oh, it would be neat if Into the Furnace was already out by the time this episode comes out and you could buy it or listen to it. But I did a draft, like a handwritten draft, and some of it on the computer. And then I went through and tried to catch the typos and added a little bit here and there. I think I added a little scene with... Actually, I got to it already. I think it's in the third chapter where Will is...
staring off into the distance and he doesn't realize that he's been doing it for hours. But now I'm on the last draft of the novel, which is recording it aloud. And it takes so, so long to record each one of these chapters because if I say it aloud and there are times when it sounds awkward or where it needs a modifier, it needs an extra word just for rhythm, or I realize that I used the same word in that paragraph and now here it is in this paragraph, or there are a couple of continuity errors that I've caught. And this is like the third day I've been recording this episode. And so I may have already told this story, and I apologize if that's the case. But reading it aloud has made such a difference. There's a huge leap in quality between the second draft and the third draft than between the first draft and the second draft, because practically every single sentence I am listening to with a magnifying glass now. You know what I mean by listening to? Now, Into the Furnace will probably get a fourth draft while I'm editing the audiobook. I'll catch a couple of things that I didn't catch while I was recording it because I'm focusing on the performance and also focusing on, you know, how things sound, phrasing, and such. So it may be that the actual published book is going to vary from the audiobook in a little place here and there, just because I realize that there's something that needs clarification. Or what was it? The town that Will Ford is from is Shady Gulch. But halfway through the story, the town that he is from became Shady Glen. And so I had to stop and go, oh, shoot. What am I going to do? And I decided, well, I like Glen better than Gulch. Gulch is a weird word. Gulch is not a word we use anymore. And so I changed it to Glen. But there's those sort of things that will come up when I'm doing the final editing on the audio, where I realize that a character, you know, had an American name in the first time he showed up in chapter 1, but when he shows up in chapter 17, he's got a Hispanic name. The story takes place in New Mexico, and because I don't really know what New Mexico was like in 1896, is it 1896? No. Birth of a Sidekick takes place in 1896. I don't know when Into the Furnace takes place. But I don't know how Mexican a town on the frontier would have been when this book takes place. My guess is that there were a heck of a lot more Mexicans than you see in Western movies from, you know, the 40s, 50s. Because, not because of whitewashing, but because of, you know, the intended audience. It makes for easier storytelling if everybody in the movie is Caucasian and speaks English. But yes, my advice stands. Read it aloud. If you really want to reward yourself in the long run, have a recorder going while you read it aloud. Maybe you can just focus on the performance and then listen to the recording with a red marker in hand or with your document and make the changes then of the things that, ooh, that didn't sound right, or, oh, ew. And, you know, you will find that there are times when you stumble over language, when you stumble over phrasing or words or dialogue, and that's a red flag that maybe it's awkward, maybe it's unnatural, maybe it needs to be rephrased. I have discovered that I have characters nod a lot. You know, Will nodded, Ben nodded, Laura Lee nodded, Chino nodded. To me, somebody nodding takes the place, or you know, Chino shook his head. It takes the place of writing said Chino, or Chino said in that sentence. But I like putting in, I like designating who says dialogue every so often. You've seen books where they don't do that, where it's just trading off dialogue back and forth. And you know who it is speaking in each time. But, you know, if you have to put the book down for a minute or you know, glance away, answer the phone or what, or poo, you look and it's like, oh, wait, now who is this? Oh, shoot. I don't know. So I like putting in said will. Will asked. Will wondered aloud. I like putting those in there. And then when people do audio adaptations, podcasts of my stories, it does bother me when they drop those. Because they, a lot of times we're doing things in full cast. There is a certain mindset that you don't need those anymore if it's full cast. And that makes for absolutely shitty audio dramas sometimes. The way around it, in my humble experience, is that you have characters unnaturally say each other's names often so that you keep people straight. Even if the two voices sound completely different, we don't know who that first voice is. Do you know what I mean? Let's say there's the sheriff and the deputy talking back and forth, and you've got two men speaking. You need every once in a while a character saying, "What do you mean, sheriff?" So that you realize that that's the deputy. And that's audio drama. In a story, you don't need that so much. It's always weird when somebody does it. Stephen King would always be like, "Jeremiah Tobiasen, how long has it been since I saw you?" And he's like, you know, "Edith O'Wharton, how many times have I told you not to climb on the trees?" And maybe in Maine, where he comes from, people do that. They say the full name of whoever they're speaking to. But whenever I see that in a movie, I go, ugh. Whether people actually speak that way or not, it feels like I'm saying exposition while I'm saying my dialogue. And anyhow, I'm going to think about a couple more pieces of advice. But yeah, chief and first and foremost, and the sheriff, he asked, read it out loud. And it will help you. I before I ever had a podcast, I would record these stories for posterity. When I first got a computer and it had a microphone, oh, it was so exciting for me that I was like, oh, I can record my stories and listen to them in the future. And I did that at first. Boy, it was terrible. There was some program that was on Windows, like Windows 95 or Windows 98, whatever I had. But it would only let you record a minute at a time. And so doing a whole short story where it only lets you record a minute at a time and you have to pay attention to when that minute runs out was excruciating. But it was doable because you could record for 50 seconds or whatever, save that, go on, record the next 50 seconds, save that, go on, and then in some big program, and you know, I used Audacity early on, and I liked it, even though it would crash all the time. And it still crashes every once in a while, but not like it used to. But once I realized, you know, you could put all that together, that was good. And then when I could record stories onto CDs and listen to them like on a road trip. Now, I used to drive to go see my parents for Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, and it would be about a 12-hour drive each way, which is a lot of listening or to music or audiobooks. And, you know, I didn't really have access to audiobooks in those days. I wish I had been smart enough to realize that the library might have them and I could just check one out and listen to it on the drive. But yeah, one of the things I would do would be to listen to recordings of my stories that I had done. And as I was listening, I would realize areas that weren't very strong. I would realize dialogue that wasn't, you know, a better line would be. And, you know, sometimes I would go home and I would incorporate those notes into the story itself, making the story better. But by the time you burned it onto a CD, it's kind of done. You know, that, or at least that's how I felt back then, because it was a lot of work. I mean, not nearly the amount of work that doing one of these does is now. But in those days, it was just for me, and maybe a friend of mine would listen to the audio. Not usually, but it's just for me. And I thought that that was really cool. I thought it was really fun to be able to produce my own stories in that way, to do audiobooks in that way. But it was helpful. So, wow, this is the world's longest episode. We may have to break this into three, even though there's not that many questions.
You know, just from where I am right now, other advice I would give is, hey, don't procrastinate. If there are things that you want to do, just try them, do them. Learn how to do things by doing it. You know how I was talking about the screenplay that I wrote, the first screenplay? I learned how to write a screenplay, not from a book, but from doing it, and then doing it again, and doing assignments, and seeing how flashbacks worked, and intercutting worked. And when Big got the idea to do a podcast, we're like, oh, wow, that sounds like it would be really cool. But there's going to be a lot of logistics. Oh, gosh, I wonder, you know, it might be really difficult. Does it cost money to do a podcast? Or do you have the donation button? How does all that work? Oh, geez, we'd have to create our own website. We have to come up with a name for the podcast. We did that for a year. For more than a year. Before we ever actually came out with our first episode of the Doonstief. And sometimes I think about, well, what if we had started in 2007 instead of 2008? You know, we'd have a whole year under our belts more than we did, especially in those days when we could put out so many more episodes than we did now, than we do now. Think of what it would be like to have another 30 episodes or 25 episodes. Part of it was, you know, we didn't know how to do it, but part of it was fear. Part of it was, oh, geez, what if nobody listens? That sort of thing. The same thing with me writing a novel or publishing my writing. You know, I heard about self-publishing years before I ever did it. And I always thought, oh, gosh, you know what would be cool is if I had a template for one short story with all the formatting perfect and the title page and all that stuff perfect. And then every time I went to publish a short story, I could just paste it into that template. I wouldn't have to do any of that stuff and figure out how it works. I could just paste it. And it was years after I heard about self-publishing that I finally did it. And, you know, my stuff is probably not as good as yours would be, whoever you are listening, as far as the formatting goes, as far as how the file works, as far as how professional it all seems. But who cares? If I have stuff out there and you don't, then I'm making money off of that writing and you're not. Now, I'm not making a lot, but I'm making something. And if I had started doing that, self-publishing, when I first got the idea of, gosh, I can do that. Ben, I can be a Jedi. Ben, tell him I'm ready. I would have been way ahead. Who knows how many of my short stories would be out there available to buy right now. So there's that. As far as like doing my own audiobooks goes, or, you know, being an audiobook narrator for other people, I found out about that pretty much the end of 2012. January of 2013, I met Renee Chambliss for the first time. She was talking about how it worked. And probably by March of 2013, I was doing it. So that's one of those times where I actually didn't procrastinate and delay and, you know, teeter-totter between, oh, I want to do it. But that was something I just jumped into with both feet. And I've since gone a little bit more to the shallow end, but they sent me my tax forms, you know, after at the beginning of the year, the beginning of 2016, to do taxes on what I made in 2015. And there was definitely income there from doing audiobooks. Some of them don't sell very well, but if you have a bunch of them out there and each one sells a couple of copies a month, that adds up. We haven't gotten to the point where I am making a lot of money on my audio. But we have gotten to the point where if I made a fund or an account that's just the audio money And I said, I'm going to use this account just to buy pizza. I could always eat pizza. Which is a weird way of saying that, you know, it's not a lot, but it's something. And I am happy about that. If I kept up the productivity I had in 2013, if I kept that up in 2014 and 2015, oh my gosh, I would have so much more stuff out there. But because I jumped in with both feet, and it was over my head, and I had to tread water for a while, I got tired. I got burned out. And so, you know, just keep that in mind. If you wanted to start a podcast, if you wanted to start self-publishing, if you wanted to write a novel, you do run the risk of getting tired, of it being work. But isn't everything work? Isn't exercise work? Isn't becoming an artist work? Isn't maintaining your luxuriant head of hair work? There's a lot of stuff that's worth pursuing in life, and it's almost all work. So there's that. Wow, I'm paranoid at how long I perceive this episode as being. Maybe it hasn't been so long, so that's why I said perceive. But it feels like I've already spent at least an hour answering these questions. And if that's the case, then maybe I should split it into 3 episodes. Or heck, maybe I could split it into 4 episodes and I'd do a month thing where every week there's a new Rish Outcast and an apology at the beginning of each episode for how indulgent they are. We'll see. But to finish up the answering of that last question, I'm not a wise man. And, you know, I've got a lot more failures under my belt than I have successes. But, you know, my advice would be to try it, to try everything, you know, to throw your hat over the wall and not be afraid to fail. Now, this is advice that I'm trying to tell myself as a grown man. But I recognize that I'm not typical when it comes to writers. I'm not typical when it comes to people. And a lot of times folks will say to me, why would you be afraid to share your stuff? I don't get it. Remember there was that story. There was a story called Leap of Faith, I think, that I wrote. And I got it ready for either Smashwords or Amazon. You know, I did the formatting. And I went out and I found an image. And it was an image of a statue. And I zoomed in on a I almost said on a certain part of the statue, on the shoulders of the statue, and then I made my title, you know, Rish Outfield, Leap of Faith, and then I chickened out. After getting that far, I chickened out in putting it out. That was, what, a year ago? Maybe more than a year, and it still just sits. No one has ever read that story, and wow, that's sad. There is no reason for that, except for that I have an illness, a mental block. And it's not, you know, just in sharing my stuff. It is an absolute pathology of self-loathing and sense of inferiority, sense of worthlessness. Now, you've heard me talk about this a lot because it's something that follows me around. It's one of the characteristics that defines me. You know, if somebody had suffered a great deal or if somebody is part of an oppressed minority, they might use that to define them. And I certainly use my failings and my loneliness as not a badge of honor, a badge of dishonor, but it's like it's who I am. And it's a shame. Do you remember that old Groucho Marx quote where he said, I would never want to belong to a club that would have someone like me for a member? And I get that. I really do. When somebody shows me attention or affection, I wonder what's wrong with them. They can do so much better. Which is too bad. It's not cool that I'm that way. But it's been that way for all these years. And it seems unlikely to change. So maybe that's something I just need to work on every single day. You know, Big was talking about having a bunch of affirmations. You know, things that he has written down that he says to himself, a mantra that he says, such as, you know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me, which Stuart Smalley would say on Saturday Night Live. And here's the funny thing. My mom had never watched Saturday Night Live, but for one of my birthdays, she actually got me the Stuart Smalley book, I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me, with no irony at all. She thought that this is a book that you give to someone and it makes them have good feelings about themselves. When, it totally isn't that. But if, you know, somebody wanted my advice, I've given some, but, you know, the other advice is don't be me. And you're already way better off than you were before. Tom didn't lob me any softballs here, did he? But I think he was asking questions because he hoped that they would inspire conversation, that they would inspire a more interesting answer than, you know, I worked at McDonald's and they never put me at the drive-thru because they knew I wasn't good enough. So, yeah, that was a bad job because I would have liked to work the drive-thru because that would have been neat. See, that's a lame thing I just said. I mean, it's all been lame, right? You're damned right it has been. Hey, thank you, sir. It's all been lame. But, you know, some things are lamer than others. Boy, part of me wonders if I should even release this at all. Maybe just send this to Tom. I have done episodes that were just for one person before. It seems like Big and I did an episode for our favorite listener 5, 6, 7 years ago. And it was probably a 10-minute episode or whatever. It was just something funny that I thought would be interesting, where we both talk to him as though he's in the room, you know, we're doing an episode for him. So yeah, maybe I should just send this to Tom. Because, you know, how much truth is too much truth? How much of a glimpse of the real me is too much? And I guess that's a rhetorical question. But I don't know. Big today said that he looked at our stats. I guess there was a time when the Rish Outcast and the Ankle Cast were on the Doonstie feed. And I honestly didn't remember that was the case. But I believe him. And he said that, you know, he looked at the stats of how many, is it downloads or listens, those episodes got. And he said, you know, they weren't like a Doonstie episode. They didn't get as much play as a Doonstie episode, but they got a heck of a lot more attention than they do now, where they're not on the feed being handed to everyone. And so, yeah, he's right there. I would like more listeners of this show, but isn't there also something kind of nice about the intimacy of imagining that there's three people out there, all of whom are friendly with me, all of whom I would consider my friends, or at least my Facebook friends? If you're not my Facebook friend, if you're listening to this, friend me by all means. Because, holy cow, I mean, you have been in a car with me for X number of hours. I feel like you've gotten to know me. That means something. I just killed the engine. I'm not going to go on to the next question yet. But I am going to go in the house and we'll get back to this later. Thank you. Good night.
The Rish Outcast is presented under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives license. That license enables you to share the file with anyone, but not to charge for it or alter it. A license to kill, by the way, enables me to kill anyone I please, whenever I please. You judge which is better.
What is the worst that can happen, huh? For example, if I succeed in my goals, the worst is that I'm absorbed by my fascination with my business. If I succeed in my goals, the worst that could happen is that I would be so absorbed by my fascination with my business that I ignore my wife and my marriage fails.